Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week it's our resident graduate from the University of the West of England Economics Department as a mature student, Alan Brown. How does the EU work? Well, just spelling it out in a way that the mass media never seems to do. And also options for Brexit. So that could be the no Brexit, that could be the EEA, the EFTA, the WTO or the SEPA. The Norway deal, the Canada deal. Alan takes us through the various options. And free movement of capital, how that brought Hitler to power in the 1930s. A little known tale there from Alan Brown. Also, Maurice Kirk is back after about 2 years. He's used to be a regular on this programme. He's a bit of a jailbird, but he's been bullied by the establishment. He keeps fighting them and he keeps ending up in jail. Also, he's been to see Sabine McNeil in prison, another one of the previous guests on here who used to run a blog called Victims Unite. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft on Jamaica Street. If you've someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer yourself, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
Alan Brown, I've done economics BA. And
whereabouts did you do that?
UWE.
So as a mature student, why did you decide to go and do this as a mature student then?
I was interested in the subject, and the old kind of saying is that if you want to understand anything, follow the money. So that's what I wanted to do.
And you did follow the money. What did you find?
Well, the way kind of ideology and self-interest sort of interlink and become almost indistinguishable.
What ideology?
It depends, but say neoliberalism is set up as an ideology, but it also serves vested interest. It's difficult sometimes to work out which bit is which.
So it sounds to me like there is a system out there that sort of channels money towards people who have a certain belief and attitude in life, which is not necessarily conducive to a good society. I mean, that's what seems to happen, isn't it, nowadays, is yes. We've got a bizarre situation at the moment with Jeremy Corbyn saying, well, we must stay in the EU because this will be good for business and will create jobs. Now, that traditionally is a Conservative Party argument.
Yes. I mean, it's difficult to say. I don't see how sort of democracy or a progressive agenda is compatible with free movement of capital, which enables speculators and undermines government policy.
Okay, well, this is all sort of a deeper background, I suppose, to the Brexit debate, the dreaded Brexit debate. But, you know, I think one of the reasons that people have been turned off, well, not only is the fact that it's been dragged out such a long time, but it's also because a lot of it is talked about in quite a superficial manner. But as an economist, you've been drilling into, for example, the EU structure. So can you take us through that?
Well, the basic structure of the EU, the two common bits are the common market, which is you have zero tariffs between the countries in the EU, but a common external tariff. And then the other sort of central part of it is the single market, which consists of the four freedoms of capital, of goods, of services, and of labour.
Let me just stop you there, because you're talking there about almost a parallel between goods and people.
Yes. So this is basically set up to is that if you're free movement, then and this will enable economic growth by removing barriers. This is quite a neoliberal idea. In fact, the basic economic structure of the EU was set up by a paper by Hayek.
Now, who is Hayek?
Hayek is this Austrian economist who's got almost who was opposed to Keynes and was one of the progenitors of neoliberalism.
So he was around after the Second World War, was he?
During World War.
World War II. because there was a lot of lessons learned about economics and economic warfare,
yes,
and the disaster of what happened in pre-Nazi Germany and Nazi Germany, which then led to the Second World War, which was, I suppose, the punishment that Germany received at Versailles,
yes,
and the knock-on effects of that being a complete disaster for their economy. Anyway, back to the EU structure.
Mm.
So we've got what exactly? So we've got the four freedoms?
Yes, and state aid rules. The idea is that if you restrict government intervention in the market, then countries cannot unfairly compete against each other. One question whether that's relevant.
Well, I mean, we've got, just a minute, though, because we've got, for example, we've got in Germany, we've got state-run railways. Here, we've got privatised railways. So they're both completely different. So how come the Germans, for example, get away with not having privatised railways?
Well, they have partially privatised railways. What you have is a break-up where public services can compete for business, but they can only do so on the same basis as private industry. So it can be open to public provision, but there can be no preferential basis for them or subsidy.
Okay. What about other parts of the structure?
What do you mean? Which parts of the structure?
Of the EU structure. I mean, looking at it as an organisation, what other bits of structure are there that we need to know about?
Well, that's the two main ones. But if you're talking about the organisations, obviously it's the European Commission who monitor compliance with EU rules.
Well, hang on. The Commission is talked about as the government of Europe. The president of the European Commission, previously Donald Tusk, now going to be, I believe, Ursula von der Leyen.
Yes.
These people have been talked about as the president of Europe. So it's effectively a cabinet and a president.
Yes, I mean, they both have the right of initiation of legislation, that only they can propose legislation. And they also monitor compliance as well.
So they are the law. Okay. But anyway, we've got a peculiar thing has happened, hasn't it? Because the new European Commission has not been approved by the European MEPs, the members of the European Parliament. They haven't actually approved it, so they've had to delay bringing this new EU government in. I mean, we haven't heard much about that on the mass media, but certainly it's going to be delayed at least a month until the beginning of December.
Yes.
It was supposed to start work 1st of November, but it never happened.
No. I mean, what was supposed to happen is that the candidate is that the a candidate from the largest parliamentary grouping is supposed to go forward, approved by the European Council, which is the heads of states, heads of government, which it goes back to the European Commission, who has got right of European Commission president, who's got the right of veto, and then it goes to be rubber stamped by the European Parliament.
But the European Parliament didn't rubber stamp it?
No.
A bit of a delay. And I understand even the new EU president, Ursula von der Leyen, only just about managed to squeak in by a couple of votes of MEPs. So this is not really a marvellous mandate for an appointee government. No. So then, okay, after the Commission, what else have we got?
We've got the, like I said, the European Council, which is heads of state. They meet twice a year and they set the overall direction. Heads of state, head of government, overall direction. They also...
And this was what Juncker was president of?
Yes.
So the new president of the European Council is going to be Charles Michel, former Belgian prime minister, but he was actually booted out in Belgium. So he was rejected by the Belgian people, by the Belgian parliament. But he's been amazing. Rather than being jettisoned down the ravine, he's been rescued by Batman and brought right up, or Superman, up to become the president of the European Council. In other words, he's going to be the chair of all of the EU leaders, which Britain is no longer going to be a part of, apparently.
Yes.
So that's the European Council. What's your take on whether Brexit is going to happen and when it's going to happen?
I'm sticking to my previous sort of estimate that there will be Brexit in name only, because the Boris Johnson deal, rather like the Theresa May deal, is not an exit agreement. It's a bridging agreement where They agree to adhere basically to EU rules, and then in the political declaration, which is non-binding, they suggest over the next year or extended to come to an exit agreement, which they haven't done yet.
Okay, so what are the alternatives that might happen with Brexit? You are, I think, you know, fair play for sticking to your guns, because it does look as if that may is increasingly becoming likely that that's the way it's going, Brexit in name only. Mm. Barino, I think it's known as, yes. Isn't it? Barino. Anyway, so what are the alternatives? What are the various things that may happen?
Well, obviously, if they get their referendum, if Labour come in and people vote to stay in, then there's sort of EU membership, which is adherence to the common market and single market with the four freedoms, state aid rules.
That is really no Brexit.
No, it's no Brexit at all. Then there's the EEA Norway deal, which is which they call soft Brexit, which is kind of a bit of a misnomer. But
so what is the Norway deal?
It's what's called the European Economic Area, which consists of people in the EU and people who are part of EFTA, countries that are part of EFTA, that have signed up to the EEA agreement, which is adherence to the single market, but not in the customs union. So in a dispute between an EEA non-EU country, an EU country, the courts of justice of the European Union still rule.
Okay, so the Court of Justice is still there. And also, of course, you don't, like people who are in the EU, you are not putting commissioners forward, you don't have MEPs, anything like that.
No, you pay as well.
But you do pay, but you don't get any say.
Yes.
So that doesn't sound like too good a deal. Anyway, so what about other alternatives?
Oh, well, I'll mention one thing. My main problem, obviously, is free movement of labour and free movement of capital. My main problem with the EEA is free movement of capital, which is destabilising, and EU state aid rules.
What about migrants and freedom of movement? Is that still there in the EEA with the Norway agreement?
Yes. It's, okay, obviously, so there is an extra Schengen agreement, which some countries like Iceland are still part of, and some aren't, if you know what I mean.
All right. So so a little bit further away from Brussels is, what's the next one?
And EFTA. EEA countries are part of EFTA, but
yes, the European Free Trade Association.
Yes, which the UK set up initially. So they've got the option of signing up to the optional extra of the EEA, but EFTA by itself is essentially the Swiss deal, which is you do not have to adhere to the four freedoms or state aid rules or the common market, but you agree a bilateral free trade agreement with the EU, like the Swiss have.
Okay, so that would allow you to control, because for most people, obviously sovereignty is a large part of it. For many people, the referendum was really about unlimited migration, and people saying, well, actually, we've had enough of unlimited migration, and we don't think it's actually doing any much better for the country. A lot of people say that's one of the reasons they voted for Brexit.
I would disagree slightly, in as much as, for me, it's not the main problem, because, obviously, free movement of labour has been used as part of a wide range of strategies to control wages, but it doesn't have to be the case.
Or to drive wages down.
Yes.
And yes. Pay and conditions, hence the zero hours contracts, all that stuff.
Yes, but it's part of a wide range of policies. But the problem is, obviously, with Iceland, it's part of the Schengen and part of EEA and part of freedom of movement, and they are one of the most equal countries in the world. But the point is, they haven't got a government totally committed to crushing the poor into the ground. So you can't really, you would, for have freedom of movement, you would at least need a government less committed to crushing the poor for this to work.
Okay, so EFTA, that's the European Free Trade Association.
Yes.
This is the Switzerland deal. Then a bit further away from that is the WTO.
Yes, I mean, there are different sorts of the WTO is the basis, and they have rules themselves, but they're kind of less prescriptive about state aid, and it's only when it affects trade between countries.
Well, it might affect trade, mightn't it? Say, for example, if a major industry is nationalised.
Yes, but if it's within trade of that only country, rather than it's only when it affects bilateral trade where the WTO rules, if you know what I mean. It's EU stated it was far more prescriptive.
Okay, so this is fascinating, I think, going through the different options.
Yes.
Each one a little bit further from Brussels.
Yes.
Is there anything that's further than WTO? Because that's usually put forward as the most distant from Brussels, isn't it?
But at the moment, that's as far away as you expect. There is obviously less far away. There are kind of things like the Canada-EU deal, which is called CETA, which does have a number of problems itself. Like, for instance, it has the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, which allows investors to sue governments for things like environmental protections.
Right, so if the government puts a law which says that you've got to clean up your act, the company that's dirty then goes to court and says, well, no, we don't have to clean up our act, dear government.
Yes. Yes.
And that's something that would be part of a CETA Canada-style agreement.
Yes.
What about you've just said that you're not so concerned about free movement of people, but you are, I know, concerned about free movement of capital. Why?
Yes.
Why?
Well,
because that's what the EU is all about, surely.
Yes, I mean, if you look at, say, China and some of the more successful industrialized economies, they have intentionally not introduced free movement of capital because it enables speculators, undermines government policy, undermines long-term investment, because that hot money can come in, come out, and destabilise economies, exchange rates.
I mean, in Japan, for example, I know that they have very strict rules over small businesses and big businesses. So big chains, which have massive amounts of finance, cannot come into towns and cities as they've done all across this country, and provide loss leaders so that small businesses, local businesses go out of business. And then, of course, once those local competition has gone out of business, these chains then put their prices up. And in Japan, you simply can't do that. What's happened in the Europe, really, since the single market seems to be, and this may have something to do with this free movement of capital, that money can come in, take over a market, destroy the local people's attempts to, you know, do whatever it is, and then disappear.
Yes.
But anyway, so, you know, what other effects are there of having free movement of capital?
Well, you can say, well, I'll attract, this country has become over-dependent on foreign direct.
I mean, we're always hearing in Bristol we need to attract investment. And, of course, you need free movement of capital to do that.
Yes, but I would say that's, I mean, China says not, because money that can come in quickly can leave quickly. This is the problem with, so you don't get that idea of long-term investment. And the problem is if a foreign country or invest in a foreign country owns a productive enterprise in, say, the UK, when you sell it off, that improves sets off the kind of current account deficit. But the problem is, what happens then is it worsens the current account deficit, because the money generated in the UK goes, profits go abroad.
So why does the current account deficit matter?
Essentially, capital account plus current account equals zero. So the current account is, say, you sell goods abroad, you make money on foreign investments, net investments, that kind of thing, whereas the capital account is you're selling parts of the UK. So to run a current account deficit, you either have to borrow from abroad or sell off bits of the UK, which are income-producing assets, which is not sustainable in the long term.
I mean, I think we used to call it the balance of payments.
Yes, it's still called the balance of payments. Yes.
But we don't actually – you know what? Yeah. I mean, so I'm a bit long in the tooth. I can remember when every month we would get a report on the BBC News, the balance of payments this month is XYZ, you know.
Yeah.
That seems to have been forgotten about, because apparently it doesn't matter anymore.
Yes. I would say it still it is. When you look at the figures, there comes a point where you have less bits of the UK to sell off. So.
There isn't a lot left, is there really?
No.
But the other thing which we don't hear much talked about now is disposable income. Now, this is a massively important factor for 90% of British people, is how much money you've got in your pocket at the end of the month once you've paid the rent, the water rates. No, hang on, it's not the water rates anymore. But anyway, your your basic overheads every to just to live. How much you've got left in your pocket at the end of the month? I mean,
and how much debt you're servicing as well?
Of course.
Yeah.
But how are various of these options likely to affect that, if at all?
Well, it's difficult to say, to be perfectly honest, but
I mean, what we're hearing from the Labour Party, for example, is that staying in the EU with really no Brexit at all is going to be best for jobs, and therefore people are going to have more disposable income.
I would say it may be in the short term, but the long term is a bit more difficult. But because the problem with the UK is it's over dependent on services, over dependent on debt, deindustrialised with a growing current deficit. We can't really continue with the collapse in oil reserves and dependent on a kind of parasitical financial class in London. Dependent on that, because you just get worse booms and bubbles as debt is wrapped up into the next kind of housing bubble and bust. It doesn't. So the UK needs to reindustrialise, which would need state aid to restructure away from over dependence.
Can we afford to do that?
I would say you can't afford not to, because you come to a point where you can no longer afford to bail out the banks, and you can no longer afford that current account deficit, because eventually the speculators, especially with free movement of capital, will attack your currency.
Well, let's go back to have a little look at free movement of currency. Mm-hmm. We've got goods, we've got human beings, but what about currency going backwards and forwards wherever it wants, all around the EU? Now, this did affect Germany particularly badly, didn't it, after World War One? What happened there? This is in the 1920s and early 30s.
It's often misread as that, you know, hyperinflation brought Hitler's power. This is kind of nonsense, because hyperinflation was due to the unpayable debt of the Versailles Treaty.
The Versailles Treaty was what was signed in just outside Paris at the end of the First World War by the Allies and Germans.
So. Yes. Keynes resigned. He was part of the Treasury at the time, and then wrote a paper the following year, 1990, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which he predicted quite accurately what was going to happen.
Yeah, and he was involved, wasn't he, at the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of World War Two, and he sort of got he got his revenge in a way.
44. It was a kind of hotel in America, and in 44 they decided to draw up the post-war economic settlement.
This is the things like the World Bank, the IMF and all that.
Yes.
Special drawing rights. Yes. The petrodollar, well, I don't know if it was the petrodollar exactly, but the idea of the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
Well, the Keynes wanted the bankor, which was an international currency. He didn't want to have freedom of capital because of the effects on Germany. The effects on Germany were you had a fixed currency, rather like the euro, unpayable debt, then you had freedom of capital, with Germany under the Dawes Plan having to borrow from the United States to pay its unpayable debt to the UK and France, who would pay their own unpayable debt from the First World War. So this merry-go-round went round until 29, when all the money, short-term money that Germany was borrowing, collapsed. It could no longer borrow because the American economy collapsed. And at that point, Heinrich Brüning came in, 30-32, tries to impose austerity in a doomed attempt under a single currency to pay unpayable debt, with America running a massive trade surplus rather than Germany does now.
So this hyperinflation, we've all seen pictures of people, piles of notes that can't even buy a loaf of bread. I mean, that surely did play a part, the economic disaster, in creating the conditions for somebody like Hitler to say, look, we need to sort all this out. This is not sustainable.
No, this is a basic misunderstanding. I mean, I'm not having a go at you, but this was 1921-23. With the Dawes Plan, 24, I think it is, where borrowing from the United States would be used to kind of finance the unpayable debt. It should have been written off, though, and you'd better. Support for the far right and the Freikorps collapsed during the boom of the 20s. It was only with the 29 crash and deflation, not hyperinflation, that brought Hitler to power, brought on by unsustainable austerity used to pay unpayable debt.
Austerity, folks, can lead to the far right coming to power. Yeah. That's certainly one thing well worth it. And so how does this all relate to free movement of capital? Why are we thinking about that now?
Essentially, rather like Northern Rock, Germany was financing its unpayable debt with borrowing from the United States, which, because it was a free movement of capital, as soon as America turned off the taps, it could no longer finance its economy or its war debt.
So
that free movement of capital helped transferred the, especially under a single currency, the 1929 crash to the rest of the world, particularly to Europe and particularly to Germany, because it was so dependent on it.
What about... fascinating, but what about the Lisbon Treaty? This is coming into effect at the moment. It was 2008, I think, quite a long time ago. Yeah. Many of the countries that didn't like the EU constitution found it in 2005, found it coming back in 2008. Pretty much the same exact wording. No longer a constitutional change, but just a treaty. Now, that fact that it was a treaty meant, you know, just that word meant that it was to be dealt with by governments, not through parliaments and through plebiscites, referenda, that sort of thing, which the constitutional change obviously would have to. So what's going on with the Lisbon Treaty?
Well,
and what does it actually mean to the... I mean, we don't understand, generally, we don't understand the way the EU works very well because it's not explained in the mass media. We don't see it kind of... In a way, we do see what happens in our own parliament, but not so much what happens in the EU parliament or in those other institutions. They're just not so they're not so transparent. But how does the Lisbon Treaty change the way the EU is operating?
Well, I would say the big change, obviously, is the Maastricht Treaty, because the Maastricht Treaty removed from the EEC.
That was 93, I think.
Yes. That moves from the EEC to the EU, and that's when properly the single market with the four freedoms comes in properly.
Okay, but what about Lisbon? How is it changing things?
Well, Maastricht Treaty sets up the conditions for the launch of the single currency in kind of 1999 to 2001.
The euro,
yes, and the Lisbon Treaty embeds that, makes introduces qualified majority voting, removes the ability of the Council of the European Union to block legislation. It's council ministers to block legislation, because the legislation which is covered by unanimity is reduced. So the ability to block legislation is reduced. Qualified majority of voting is introduced in the...
Well, I mean, you could put it another way and say, well, that's the end to the veto, because this is something that we've always been told the EU has. Any member of the EU can veto anything, really.
Well, there's two parts of the veto. There's obviously the legislative process, which is mainly co-decision, which is European Commission proposed legislation. It's voted on by the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament. If they agree, then if it's, in some cases, it has to be ratified by member governments. But if it's the sole prerogative of the EU, then it doesn't have to be ratified by member governments.
Well, that's handy.
Yes.
So is Lisbon having much of an effect?
Well, the Lisbon Treaty also deepened the Stability and Growth Pact, the Fiscal Compact, which was... is also been amended since the Lisbon Treaty. Like, for instance, member governments of the euro have to have their budgets pre-approved by the European Commission.
Well, why is it, do you think, that we don't get the way that the EU operates explained to us by the mass media? Is it because it's so complicated?
It's horrendously complicated.
Deliberately so?
I would say so, because if you look at a kind of sort of a map of all the various organisations. It's not simple like, well, relatively simple like the, say, UK Parliament, where you just have two legislative
bodies. We've got a Queen, haven't we? We've got a Cabinet, and we've got a Parliament.
Yes,
and the Lords. Okay, so you've got things like the Privy Council, you've got things like the House of Lords, but they're largely kind of down the side. Yes. The main decision-making is process common, is easy to see.
Yes.
Where's the equivalent in the European Union?
Well, it's split in as much as the European Commission is the only body with the right to introduce legislation. So you can't vote in the European elections for somebody that can introduce legislation.
I mean, doesn't that happen in Britain too? Mainly the government is introducing legislation, not MPs.
No, but you can vote for a party that will become a government that can propose legislation. They stand on a manifesto.
But you can't vote for the EU Commission.
No.
Alan Brown, thank you very much for joining us again and helping us understand a little bit more about how Brussels operates.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Maurice Kirk, sometimes known by some as the Flying Vet. My last aircraft is waiting for me in Central Africa at the moment, having landed in the war zone of South Sudan, running out of height ideas, daylight, all at the same time. And I have been detained in a Welsh prison, two Welsh prisons, for the last 9 months due to my posting something inadvertently to a Member of Parliament.
Now, so white powder? What sort of white powder?
Well, my MP then was Alan Cairns, a very good, now resigned Secretary of State for Wales. And I must have taken critical documents concerning my civil claim against the South Wales Police that's now in its 27th year. The lawyers for the police have claiming nearly £2 million now in costs. I've had one bill of almost £1 million, and apparently there's another one in the wings, all paid for by the taxpayer at the moment, and with no control, which is why I'm so outraged. And this 8 months and the white powder was, I was sending to Alan, whose children went to school with my lovely little daughter, was following me and supporting me for the last 10 years. And I've been reporting him about the general state of the law courts and the prisons just as an inside information for my local MP. Unfortunately, I took off the wall of my cell a few critical documents like transcripts and so on. And of course, the prisoner, all he's got to stick on the wall is toothpaste.
So you haven't got any blue tack or anything like that?
No.
So you're using toothpaste?
No, you're not allowed blue tack.
Okay, so let's just imagine here, you've got toothpaste and after a while that might dry out and go powdery. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, when Celia, my sister magistrate, who's been on your program before, came to the parole board hearing to give evidence due to the new regulations in July, she was very quick to point out that I was lucky that they weren't prosecuting me for heroin. They have admitted at the parole board hearing only 2 weeks ago, that caused me instant release from prison, that the powder was, quote, wait for it, a harmless, unidentified white powder. Now, where's the English in that?
I mean, that could be flour or something, couldn't it, really? So anyway, so you're out now. What about you're saying you've got beaten up. And that is rather
seriously.
Serious, isn't it? Now, think it's something to do with, is it G4S, the private security firm?
Yes.
So what was the occasion of that? What was happening there?
In last December, the 4th of December, One of the organisations to do with me being detained in prison, which I cannot identify, but you can use your imagination, released papers which clearly showed that I had false criminal convictions for narcotics, firearms, wait for it, child abuse. It told me that the South Wales Police had been using these criminal convictions recorded. They have been using false... This is why I'm so angry. And my sister, who came across from Jersey to give evidence at the parole hearing, the South Wales Police, to slow down my litigation to which I'm entitled under the rules of law, which we have still in England, powers of redress. I had won over 50 criminal prosecutions, and from 1993 I have spent 27 years trying to get compensation for the false imprisonments. It's caused me five years
So what about... Yeah, let's get back to these so-called allegations of... convictions on these other serious charges. So what was revealed about those?
Right. What was revealed to me on the 4th of December last year was that they were recognised, circulated worldwide... criminal convictions held by Maurice John Kirk, date of birth 12345.
Sounds to me, that you've been smeared with these charges. The idea is that everywhere you go with your passport,
yes,
it's going to be red lights, yes, flashing everywhere.
Yes, and every time I come from Brittany, where I'm trying to write a book in my little house, each time I come into Portsmouth, I have a little bet with people in the queue. You watch, when I get up there, they'll stop, and somebody will come in the room, and a light will go on, and they'll delay me.
So at least you've now found out why this is.
Yes.
Is there any reason, any way you can get rid of these false convictions?
Oh, no, they've now been removed.
Oh, good.
And if it wasn't for the tenacity of certain people who I can't name until my license restrictions are finished, guess what? On the day of the election, I can then go public. Because, of course, we can get the tape recording of the parole board hearing.
But anyway, let's go back to you being beaten up. Where were you being taken from and to?
The parole board hearing, which is an indictment in itself, caused me to have immediate release. And they came to my cell, four of them.
So were you at the hearing?
At the hearing. My sister Celia was at the hearing. I was in a wheelchair. I was already in a lot of pain. And they came into my cell on my release, and they picked me up bodily, rammed my arms behind my back, and put handcuffs on. This is for release from a British prison. I mean, only today, Mr. Cheng in China was saying how he was kidnapped by the Chinese and how he was treated. Well, I was being treated in Wales, not in such a bad way, but these four prison officers then became eight prison officers because they would not let me walk.
Now, are these prison officers, are they employed by the state, or
private? That is the problem. I kept asking to be put in a state-run prison, run by the government under clear government rules, and they are accountable to themselves. But G4S have been so naughty, they have lost the contract for renewal, and they're now fleecing the taxpayer, not only for what they can get, but the prisoners, like me, are being denied the extras, like getting access to the library, to the law books, to the telephone. All sorts of things have been restricted in Park Prison, Bridge End, because of money.
Okay, so just paint us a picture of what conditions have been like inside this G4S prison.
Well, I was put deliberately in a corner cell where the CCTV did not cover me. And for the last 3 months, 4 months, I've had urine poured under my door. I've had foul language shouted through the door. I'm not going to repeat the words they use. I had been, in their eyes, convicted for child abuse. And that has now been squashed officially by the system. By the parole man himself, it said at the parole, what we call the panel member. I can't obviously name him because it'd be quite improper. But I had urine on my bed. I had eggs thrown in my face and smashed on the walls of my cell. And
this was because rumours had been circulated, false rumours, that you were a paedophile.
The prisoners, and it culminated with the prison officers showing off to the prisoners by manhandling me off the ground and eight of them taking me the full length of a very big prison, I mean, 1,000 prisoners. And I was in screaming with agony, and this was deliberate to show off to the prisoners. And they were witnesses to the bullying I was having for months and months, and the urine, no one would come and clear it up. I was on sticks, and it was so obvious that G4S were a party to the criminal conduct.
Why do you think you were being treated like that?
My father refused to be a Freemason. My mother never had time to be a magistrate here in Taunton, where I'm now living. I'm based in Taunton before I carry on around the world. And I could see by the conduct and the discussions that the Englishman had caused them aggro. Why? Because I'm entitled to have redress for them losing 113 criminal convictions, of which I won 89%.
I mean, this all goes back, doesn't it, to you, yes, you evicting somebody from some premises where drug dealing was going on, and that person was connected to some superintendent in South Wales Police.
Yes, yes. That was actually the daughter of a high-ranking officer who was a client of mine. It was actually, they were living above the surgery.
Is when you're, as a veteran
yes,
surgery.
Yes, and the police used sledgehammers to go in and smashed in the doors and evicted the couple. And I won it. I mean, I've won 89% of the court cases. And now they're determined that the machine gun case, which comes to trial, to a substantive hearing on the 24th of January this year, next year, when they are going to try and strike it out. Because the police said, how can we keep Kirk locked up to slow down his civil claims? Ah, he used to have a gun. Brian Trubshaw, captain, old friend of mine, got me to fly to Farnborough Air Show in 2001, I think, or 2000. And let's go and get it. And they went to the museum up in Lincolnshire, two police officers, and brought back a prohibited weapon, Section 5 of the 68 Act. The regulations are that there'll be a minimum of three, and that they wear firearms. And even during the trial, my son, Casper, commented that at the end of each day of the two-week farcical machine gun trial, a policeman would come in and pick it up and put it over his shoulder and walk off down the street to the local police station. Everybody knew. And the jury, of course, I may have told you before, were waiting outside. They were so angry. They dragged me into a pub, and which was very funny at the time, because they caught hold of me. And I said, oh, madam, ladies, I'm very dangerous. I've been locked up for 8 months. And we all started laughing. And they said, but how could they have brought the buyer of the aeroplane, of the machine gun, and the person who sold it to you as prosecution witnesses? Why weren't they in the dock with you? And I said, look, ladies and gentlemen,
I mean, this is all a case to do with a disabled machine gun that was on an old World War II aeroplane. So
yes,
really, should have been no trial in the first place. First
of course,
this is a disabled gun. And secondly, it's part and parcel of the this old vintage aeroplane. Anyway, so what about, you've also been to see an old guest of ours who we haven't spoken to, obviously, for a while, because she's in jail at the moment too, and that is Sabine McNeill. So how's she been getting on?
Well, when I got out of prison, I am restricted on where I go and where I'm allowed to sleep, all of which expires on the election day. And the first place I went to, of course, is to see my dear old girlfriend, Sabine McNeill, one of the creators of email. She was only 21 at CERN Laboratories when they developed emails, and she was one of them. And she'd been detained for a 9-year prison term I think she caught the habit from Morris. She speaks her mind. She'll only tell the truth. And unfortunately, in this day and age, Sabine was hit hard. She was the fall guy. She trusted the information she was given. And she's in consideration for deporting to Germany now.
Well, but this is the problem with her case. It looks like she was fed false information. And as a result, she refused to have that corrected by the courts. Now, that the courts don't like that. If you're going through a hearing, you're told X, Y, and Z, you've got to do it. Otherwise, you're in contempt of court. And they really do get annoyed if you've been through a hearing, you're told to do X, and you do Y instead. How is Sabine? We want to know how she is.
Sabine is a lot better. Soon as she was jailed, I was in prison, and I quickly got out a piece of paper and wrote her my 10 rules, the 10 commandments for a prisoner who is vulnerable. And off the top of my head, I can only remember the first two. And, of course, the first one is, Sabine, 1, trust no one, especially if they're in uniform. 2, toujours la politesse, always be polite. And you will have, Sabine, the prisoners and the staff, and the IMB, the Independent Monitoring Board, that are supposed to look after the welfare and independence, human rights and so on, of prisoners, were so impressed with my Ten Commandments, they stuck it on their office wall. It was Sabine that got me. She came over to France to get me involved and asked me to represent the Musa, the Nigerian children that had got snatched by Haringey Council, 6 of them, and never to be seen again, to act for them in the High Court. And, of course, I left France and went over to the Royal Courts of Justice, and that's another story in itself, which was quite frightening about what really goes on in our law courts.
Okay, so what has this whole process taught you, Morris? You know, you've been fighting and fighting for, what, 20 years? Really, will it? Because you sure?
Truth will out. I have support all over the world. But Sabine is just the same. She knows that there is only one truth. It doesn't matter how many times the police wish to vary the allegations, they've got to speak in the end. What happened? Was it an offence? And where harassment is concerned, you cannot be jailed like me for detecting or preventing crime. And that is what I am suffering. And nothing is going to persuade me, because it's the rule of law, which the Welsh have the habit of forgetting.
Is that just the Welsh?
Well, I think it's exceptional in Wales.
It's because you've really upset a very powerful policeman in South Wales, isn't it? Isn't that the only reason?
I have not upset them. They have lied consistently. The expression inherent deceit comes to mind. And I have been before 14 judges now who could have stopped this machine gun trial and for me and for my 5 years in prison, and they have lied to me.
So is that case still rumbling on, the machine gun?
It is in the county court in Cardiff on the 24th of January, and as usual, Maurice Kirk pays for lunch for anybody who wishes to come and listen to the lies and the cheating and the disgraceful behaviour of those in charge.
Now, you mentioned Freemasonry. Have you got any evidence that that really is involved?
I have, but not for you today. That is such a big subject that is under lock and key in a foreign country.
One angel in all of this seems to be Celia, your sister, who's helped a lot. I mean, do you want to just finish and tell us a bit about her?
Well, Celia was a magistrate, a children's magistrate, for many years in Jersey. And she, with all my other sons and brothers and sister, have got really, really depressed that South Wales Police had me struck off as a veterinary surgeon with the 11% that I did not win. They were nothing to do with animals. It was to do with motoring. speeding, drink drive, and things like that, fast, big motorbikes. And Celia twice has come over to try and find out why we are not getting a parole hearing, because we want the truth. And they come down from London and listen. And they, because of the change of the laws, they allowed Celia to come and sit in a couple of weeks ago and not only be an observer, but to give evidence. And we had just heard this string of lies from the Welsh authorities. And I watched the expression. One of the good things about getting old is that you can suss people from a distance as to whether they're being honest or not. There aren't many benefits of getting old, but that's one of them. And I looked at the parole board that I was before, and I knew that Celia had cracked it. And I left without a tag around my... I was going to have a tag around my ankle. I was going to have to report every hour, like last time, from some hostel. And our man from London... said, no, he can go and live in Taunton, where he was born, as long as we know where he is.
Oh, you think there's something a bit Kafkaesque about your dealings with the legal system?
Well, it's got many facets. Because of my education, and where we were brought up to be absolutely law and order in the family, we could pinch the odd partridge or pheasant or something with a silencer. But I have been so entangled with the Welsh police, and of course remember Guernsey police, and remember a certain police superintendent's notebook borrowed from the police station not 70 yards from where I live. And last week I read that they are looking for a night porter to look after the building because they've moved. And I thought, now there's a job I could do on the side, because I know it intimately.
And are you still flying?
Oh, well, yes, I will be, when I've sorted out...
I mean, how have you managed to keep up your hours for your pilot's licence?
No, well, I've got quite a few thousand, but I just dreamed it in prison. But I have to go and get a flight test and a medical.
I mean, am I right in thinking you're one of the few people that's flown under the Severn Bridge? Is it actually, it's a bit of a... And, of course, there were some that flew underneath the Clifton Suspension Bridge as well, I think, too. Even one in a jet. And then there was a crash, as I remember.
Well, I am a bridge expert.
Of course, we mustn't be encouraging anyone to do this. No, but those were different days in a war.
But when it comes to the Bristol Bridge in 1968, when they were just putting in the last section,
the old Severn Bridge.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. I couldn't possibly comment. But you did mention my favourite when I was a veterinary student here, because we used to climb in the gorge, and. That is a bridge that is being retained in my thoughts for when I'm not allowed officially to fly. And it may be, you never know, the last flight I do.
Right, but what about is it impossible that someone will ever fly under the Clifton Suspension Bridge again, do you think?
It's a huge area of airspace. I mean, was it 4 seconds to drop a stone? I mean, what height is that? Was it 250 feet?
Is it possible to do? Would you do it?
Well, like, as I just said earlier, I couldn't possibly comment.
OK, Maurice Kirk, thanks very much for joining us. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees and subscribe to our email list if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. So, thanks to our guests, Alan Brown and Maurice Kirk. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us. Offer hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in the UK via the national volunteering website do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8pm. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
That's your lot from me tonight. Thanks very much for listening. John.
Thanks, Andy. Smart shirt. And good evening, fans. And you may recall, some of you, if you read the NME at the end of last year, beginning of this, that I expressed that my resolution, my ambition for 1992, was to shake Diplo Dubala by the hand. This afternoon, I achieved that.